Welcome to Unreal Bluegrass. My very special guest today, Edgar Winter. Edgar Winter produced an album, Brother Johnny, won a Grammy just recently. We're so happy to have him on the show so quickly after that award. Edgar's going to talk about the album, about his career, about Johnny. It's a wonderful discussion. You're going to enjoy it. It's going to kind of be an extended stay, I think. And we'll share some more tunes from the album, Brother Johnny. But you're going to learn a lot about Edgar and Johnny. It's an extremely touching album and a very touching discussion with Edgar Winter, and we thank him so much for taking part. We'll get right into our discussion with Edgar Winter. Thanks so much for tuning in. To the listeners of Unreal Bluegrass, you just heard a song, the title of which is Lone Star Blues. It's from a recent album entitled Brother Johnny. Just won a Grammy Award. And I have on the phone today Edgar Winter, of whom I'm a huge fan of Edgar and Johnny Winter both, and we're going to talk to Edgar about music, and particularly this album, and getting it together, and just whatever else comes up. But I wanted the audience to hear Lone Star Blues with Keb Moe on slide guitar, and I want to welcome Edgar to the show. I appreciate your time so much.
Oh, thank you, Steve. Are you ready to rock and roll?
You had to do that.
Of course, I have to do that.
You know, Johnny Winter. We were talking off the air. And the reason that I kind of wanted to go with this totally different style of acoustic slide, but I wanted to talk to you about Johnny's great guitar player, great rock player, and I know that I've read everything in the packet, by the way. The album has a great, I don't know, what's it, 25 or 30 pages of information inside a book that you can really just delve into what you're thinking about and why you put this record together. But Johnny was, to me, the absolute epitome of acoustic slide guitar. I've never heard anyone even close to that. There are good ones, there are bad ones. You have great players on this album, Brother Johnny, and that to me was just on electric guitar, phenomenal. But to me, if I had to say the best player ever to put a slide on their finger on acoustic guitar, in my mind, it's your Brother Johnny.
Well, thank you. I couldn't agree more. And that was Johnny's first love, was that old acoustic style, country, Delta blues, and he listened to all the old guys, you know, like Muddy, and I gravitated more toward the urban style of blues, the people like Ray Charles and Bobby Blue Bland,
yeah,
and B.B. King, but Johnny really studied that, and he knew all the alternate tunings, and Lightnin' Hopkins, and I remember the first time I heard Mean Town, and I said, oh, it's kind of like a Charlie Hooker thing, but it's got this electric rock vibe to it. How did he do that? But, yeah, I agree. Like, there are many, many great electric blues players. But as far as that authenticity, and I think that's another thing that's unrecognized about Johnny, was his fusion of blues and rock tended toward the old style Delta rather than just the modern blues of people like Stevie Ray. But I appreciate your saying it, and I couldn't agree more. And going into that song in particular, I was trying to write the song in Johnny's voice, Lone Star Blues. And this is something that we have to go back to childhood, and having read the liner notes, you'll be familiar with it.
Yeah, go ahead.
Johnny, as growing up, Johnny had the drive and determination and the ambition and the dream. He was going to be a star. And, he was Johnny Cool Daddy Winter with the pompadour and the shades and the guitar.
There are great pictures inside this album describing exactly what you're talking about, where his hair and everything. But, Go ahead. I interrupted. I don't mean to, but I just enjoyed
it. I was a quiet kid that played all the instruments. And, you know, when Johnny, we started out together as kids playing ukulele. My dad was a banjo player. He was no Bela Fleck, but he played guitar and banjo and played alto and a swing band in his youth. And he sang in the choir, and he had a barbershop quartet that would come over to the house and sing. And my mom played beautiful classical piano. But I'm getting far afield here.
The thing about Johnny
was he worked his entire life to achieve that dream. And after he had seemingly everything that recognition, respect, adoring fans, fame, fortune, money, celebrity. I remember talking to him, and he said, "Edgar, I just never thought it would be like this. I feel so alone and isolated. I don't know who to talk to or feel that I can trust." And it wasn't what he expected. And it sounds so odd to say, because fame and celebrity is such a shiny, attractive thing, and you would think, just looking at it on the surface, well, how could anybody be anything other than ecstatic and grateful? It was a difficult transition for Johnny, and he went through this period of disillusionment, and he was able to resolve that in later life. And it was his love of blues that pulled him through the, you know, he went through rehab and came back stronger than ever. And he loved his fans, and he, you know, he really came to appreciate everything he had in his career. But he did go through that difficult period. So I tried to write. I had heard him speak about that, but he never put it into a song. So I tried to write that song, Lone Star Blues, in Johnny's voice. And when I was looking for someone to do it, I said, well, it has to be a real, authentic blues guy. And I was doing this record with Ross Hogan. And I do want to thank three people. I'll start with Ross. But he started out as the engineer, mixer, and ended up just as a producer, co-creator. He and I made the record together, and he had so many great suggestions for the material and artists, people that I was, in some cases, not aware of, like he suggested Doyle Bramhall Jr. to play the slide.
Great choice.
And I always thought of him as, you know, playing with Eric Clapton, and I didn't know what a great slide player he was. I thought Joe Bonamassa did an incredible job on Mean Town, you know, doing that. But, of course, Ross did the Taj Mahal album with Taj Mahal and Keb Mo, and he put me in touch with Keb Mo, and I talked to him, and I explained the idea of the song, and what Keb Mo did to me, he really transformed that song, because if I had sung it myself, it would have only been that particular emotion that I was referring to, that frustration and disillusionment that Johnny went through. But when Keb Mo comes in on those choruses, sounds like the Lone Star Blues. It's just like the old blues master commiserating with this younger guy. Yeah. There's this note of warmth and compassion, and it completely transformed the song into something that I think is truly beautiful.
It is beautiful.
I can't thank Keb Mo enough. He broke down, you know, like his approach is not at all, Johnny is a slide player, like, you know, he loved Duane Allman and guys like that. You know, his technique was just really great. And Keb Mo, more like, he is framing the vocals.
Exactly. That's
what he does with his songs. And he does that beautifully on Lone Star. But, you know, he's very authentic in everything that he does. But I love the way our voices go together, because, you know, his just, every time I hear him come in with those choruses, it just warms my heart. So, there you go.
And it's perfect. It's a perfect Keb Mo sound. Like you said, he redid it in his style. And let me say this also about Johnny's slide playing was not to provide a fill, is to provide a turnaround lick. He was playing the heart and soul and the style and the melody of the song or the words. I mean, his slide playing was a different type of animal than what, and Keb Mo does his very well and does wonderful singing. But Johnny's slide playing wasn't just, you know, you do the Robert Johnson thing, then you do a turnaround. He was all over the real heart of the lyrics, if there were lyrics to the song. That's just my opinion. I've always thought that about him.
Well, I've always thought of Johnny as a player. I always refer to him as the Coltrane of blues rock.
Yeah.
And his and I say that if you follow jazz, Johnny had the ability to extend a solo in the same way that Coltrane did, which was to make it this endlessly inventive stream of consciousness. And he could go on chorus after chorus after chorus and keep building in intensity. And, you know, they're very, you know, just sheer speed and intensity, that was something that, that Johnny really excelled at. And I think our growing up together, jazz has a lot of fast playing in it, and, you know, we learned to play together. So speed was a part of that. But I think that it, Johnny's just deep love, and he just really listened. His heart was in that music.
Oh, gosh.
And it really comes through in slide playing in particular. You can hear all those hours that he spent listening to all of those great old blues masters.
It's perfect coming out. I mean, the tone, and, you know, it's easy to go off of the note when you're not pushing the frets. You got all that in your left hand and coming off perfectly. Let me ask you this here while we're talking. Is it my recollection, because I had the first one, and I had second winner, which I have a very specific question for you in a minute. But to me, it was when he did Nothing But the Blues, I looked at that as a comeback to where he was back to where that first and second winner album, that clarity, that playing, the one where he's on the album cover with the national guitar in the studio, that to me was just, like Johnny's back. Johnny's back as good as he ever was, if not better than he ever was. I just loved that album. I think it was like the mid-70s when he did that, 75, 77.
Yeah, I think that was about right.
Boy, it was just like perfect. It was perfect, and I had all the records in between. And I want to ask you one question before I forget. When we're talking to Edgar Winter, so grateful that you had some time to talk to us about this Brother Johnny album, which is on, I'll say, Quarto Valley Records.
Quarto Valley Records.
Yeah, and I know you're probably going to talk about Bruce in a minute, because you were talking about Ross Hallgren.
I want to thank Bruce, and I want to thank my beautiful wife, Monique,
who
I've been happily and blissfully married for some 43 years
no
now.
No kidding. Congratulations.
Not bad for rock and rollers, and in California, no less. I just wouldn't have done the record if it weren't for Monique. She convinced me to do it, and I was devastated after Johnny's passing, there was interest in a tribute album, and I did a few meetings with various companies, and they would ask questions like, how long is it going to take? How much is it going to cost? Or what guest artist can you guarantee? And I said, I don't know. I'm not even sure I want to do this. But it just felt to me exactly what it was. Deal offers, business people sensing an opportunity and wanting to exploit Johnny's name and memory, just to sell a few records. And I didn't want to be a part of that. But as the years went by, and I thought, well, somebody will probably do this, maybe Rick Derringer or Paul Nelson, but it's not going to be me. And, when I asked her about it, she was very definite. She said, well, you always talk about how Johnny's your all-time musical hero, and you wouldn't be where you are today were it not for him. And, you know, you owe this to yourself, to Johnny, and to the world. This is your chance to acknowledge that. And she couldn't have been more right on on every count and in every aspect of that. And then when I met Bruce Cordo, Bruce really loved Johnny's music. And he said, you can take as long as you want and get whoever you want to play. I love Johnny's music. I just want to bring that music back to the world and maybe to some new people that
I hope
will
so.
Be discovering and hearing Johnny for the first time.
I hope so. I hope so. That's what we do. We throw out a line and we hope someone will go back to those records that that he did, and then even also back the old records you did, which I had all those. I had all those things. So you just have to trust me on that. So it's a beautiful record, and I read what you're talking about. There's a great story, and I so appreciate the fact that you took the time to write all of your thoughts down about how this came together and who and how you contacted this player, because every player that you could want on a blues album is on there, and then some. It's just a great collection. But before I forget, because I have a post-it note that says, ask Edgar about Second Winter. Second Winter was the first Johnny Winter album I had. Bought it in vinyl at a record store back when they had those, if you recall. And you put them on your record player and you turn them over. Well, and the second disc is totally empty on the second side. And I read Johnny's notes on it, and it said, I hope you understand this. There's three sides on this two. There's three sides of music, and his explanation was, and I don't know what it means. Maybe you do. Maybe I don't. I have no idea. He says it was done that way so this album could be as technically loud as possible. Do you know what that means? Is it a recording issue that he wanted to put enough music on there, but not cut anything down as far as the size of the sound? Or can you tell me why there's a blank side on the two album disc?
Well, that is. That is true in a sense. The fact is that there was not really enough material for four sides. And but as you know, when you're cutting a record, the volume at which you can cut it and the quality and the clarity, the shorter the material is, the better it's going to sound. That's like you can get a certain number of minutes on a side at a certain level.
Yeah, okay.
And as the material shortens, the grooves can spread out. So it really does sound better. Johnny loves loud music. And he just thought it would be cool to have a three-sided.
It was cool. It was cool once I figured out the second side of the second album was not going to have anything. I mean, because I'm putting them on the thing, I'm not looking at the back. I'm looking at the inside of the jacket, and I don't really pick that up yet. So then from there, I go back and find what I call First Winter, which is really his first, the first album as he did as Johnny Winter, which is then I. So that's how we used to do stuff, Edgar. We would find an album, read it, then go back and find the other people that are mentioned, and you find out about Muddy Waters and all these people, and you learn.
And there was the Progressive Blues Experiment.
Exactly.
Before that.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And I don't have anything of that, but I'll probably get it now that I've looked into it and read everything.
Yeah.
So.
Well, that was really authentic, Johnny. That was more than the. Well, I was involved in the others, and not in the first Progressive Blues Experiment. And I had like Mean Town, and that was really the genesis of Johnny's. Fusion of rock and blues, which I think he did in a unique way that I don't think he's ever really been acknowledged.
Nope.
But his fusion of blues and rock was gravitated more toward the Delta, the
yep.
old Delta style, like Mean Town Blues, meaning like it's like an old John Lee Hooker kind of Delta riff, but it's got this electric blues rock intensity. I don't think any most of the great like people like Stevie Ray that were really great rock blues players, it was more like contemporary blues rather than going back much to those early roots. There you go.
Unreal Bluegrass coming to you from the Gold Tone Music Group studio.
You've mentioned Meantown Blues a couple times and on the album. It's the first cut on the album of Brother Johnny. We're talking to Edgar Winter about a lot of things, but we want to come back to talking about this great album. That congratulations to your effort, and you won a Grammy. I was very happy that Johnny won a Grammy for Step Ahead. I was mad that it took so long.
Yeah.
I just thought, daggone it, couldn't you have done this last year? Couldn't you have done that? All those, like, even the albums we're talking about. You mean there was no, but anyway, that's what they do. So, but Meantown Blues is the first song on here with Joe Bonamassa, and I think that Joe makes an appearance later on in one of these tunes, maybe Self-Destructive Blues, but you mentioned that a couple times.
Yeah. And I'd played some shows with Joe, but never really got to sit down and talk to him. But we were talking on the phone and, going over songs and when I got to that song and it mentioned it, oh, wow, you're really going to do Self-Destructive? Man, that's the first Johnny Winter song
I heard.
I learned that song and I played it with my band. He was just like flipping out. And when he came in, he came in with a Firebird and an old basement amp, exact same gear. And when he started to play that song, like, I closed my eyes. It was like Johnny's presence was in the room.
Oh, man.
I think of all the really such amazing performances on the record, and I've been on a lot of records, played on other people, and had lots of people play on my records, but I've never heard such an outpouring of love and respect. Just people really putting their heart and soul into something. And it wasn't just respect for Johnny or for me or for Ross, because a lot of them were people that he asked. But just, it's not only a Johnny tribute, but it's a tribute to the blues.
Exactly. And, you are exactly right.
And that's what I was trying to, And for the unique style of Texas music, this is the music that we grew up on, that taught us how to play, and it's played in the style that we played in all of the early bands, as kids growing up. And that's what makes it so meaningful to me, is the fact that we started out as kids, and our dad, he showed us our first chords on ukuleles when I was, 6 years old.
Mm.
And then Johnny graduated to guitar, and I said, well, I'll play everything else. So, I played bass for a while and drums, and then electric pianist came out, and then picked up the sax and got into jazz. But when we played Woodstock together, we were playing the blues. And that's what changed my life.
Did I read correctly, Edgar, that in the notes as your description of what's happening, that it was that Johnny had won I don't know if you were in the band or not, but I think you probably heard Johnny won some kind of award, and all of a sudden he's playing on stage, and you're with him. That story's great. I didn't know that story until I read the inside of the CD.
You talked about when we were kids.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, this is relates to the song Johnny Be Good, and you would think, well, Johnny Winter tribute, Johnny Be Good, it's obvious. It's that traditional Chuck Berry classic rock and roll. And, yes, it is that, but there is that interesting backstory, which is that after the exact time that I was talking about, when Johnny graduated to guitar and we formed our first band, Johnny and the Jammers.
And
there was this this movie called Go Johnny Go, and I think it had Jimmy Clanton, and there was a lot of people on it. Chuck Berry was in it. But anyway, there was this promotional contest in conjunction with that movie, and called Johnny Melody Contest. And so the hottest song we knew was Johnny B. Goode. So we entered this thing, and we played it, and we won. And first prize was get to cut your very own
How
record.
Cool is that?
And so this was in Beaumont, and there was a recording studio called Gulf Coast Recording. And the guy that ran it, an engineer, Jack Clement, a country guy, who he did a lot of Johnny Cash, and really cool, talented guys, and that's where we recorded our first record, which was a song Johnny wrote called School Day Blues. And as they say, the rest is history. So had it not been for Johnny B. Goode, who knows? That was what launched our professional career, being Johnny's first record. And to this day, when I think, like, when I think of rock and roll, like, to me, the, you know, it's Chuck Berry and the Blue Richards.
Yeah.
And when I think of rock and roll, I think of Chuck Berry, and I specifically think of Johnny B. Goode.
Yep.
And it's not only Johnny's story; it's the story of every young kid coming from humble beginnings who has that dream.
Yep.
Of, you know, picks up a guitar and dreams of one day I'm going to be a star. So it really tells that story. And of course, Johnny, that's the reason Johnny recorded it on the first, the CBS record. And that's of course why I had to put it on this album. And here's the weird thing about that is, I thought, like, in the making of this album, I didn't think of any song in particular in relation to a specific artist. I wanted the artist to pick the song. But I didn't want anybody on the record to play anything that they didn't feel passionately about playing. But I thought, like, Joe Walsh and I go way back, you know, when he was in the James Gang.
Yeah.
To play shows together.
Yeah.
And I think of Joe as a rocker, you know, and I thought he'd be the perfect guy, you know, to do Johnny B. Goode. And I didn't want to sing the whole song myself because I used to sing it with Johnny. And so when I asked Joe, he said, I don't know, that's just that classic Chuck Berry. I don't know what I can can bring to that. But he surprised me by picking the song Strangers, which is a very uncharacteristic Johnny song with beautiful chords. And I was just so surprised. Joe did a beautiful job of soloing on that.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned hearing that song and actually hearing it with my wife, Monique, who suggested Michael McDonald.
Wow.
Singing that song.
Floored me, Edgar. I just, for some reason, and I should have figured it out, but it was such a, go ahead, I interrupted you. We talked about this off the air, like, I couldn't, because I drive around, I didn't know, it blew me away when I finally looked at it.
Well, when you think of this, like, it just, it has that haunting, hello, pretty stranger, you know, that, like, nobody sings like that.
No.
After Joe played guitar on it, I thought, well, I don't know if you're aware of this, but, you know, I've been playing with Ringo, and Ringo Starr and his All-Stars.
Yeah, that's always a great show.
And, like, Ringo is married to the lovely Barbara Bob, and Barbara's sister, Marjorie, is married to Joe Walsh, so they're brothers-in-law.
I didn't know that.
And I thought, well, now that I've got Joe on this song, maybe I can talk Ringo into playing drums on it. And I thought, you know, he does all of those cool, spacey, and I thought, doing this ballad, he could get to do all of that stuff. And you know, I just, I didn't really think he would do it. I don't think he does that, you know, that many songs for people. Finally, I got up the nerve to call him, and he, Edgar, I'll do it for you. And that just touched my heart.
Oh,
so, now you've got, like, Joe Walsh, Ringo Starr, and Michael McDonald. What an interesting array of people that you'd never expect.
That's a killer
team. On the same album, much less the same song.
It seems to me, Edgar, you were able to get a lot of people that maybe you weren't sure of, but it seems to me, two names I'm going to ask you about in a little bit, because I know most of the people. I don't know Phil X, and I also don't know David Grissom. I don't know him. I know David Grissom is a mandolin player, but that's not him. So at some point, I know who most of these people are, I think, but I don't know Phil X. I looked him up, and but I don't know who they are. But I say that because I'm looking at Johnny B. Goode, which has Joe Walsh, and we didn't mention David Grissom, but I don't know.
I want to mention David Grissom because he was the when Joe didn't do the guitar, we didn't really finish. I got off on a tangent with
that's okay.
a stranger.
Yeah.
But I asked Joe to sing on it. I said, you know, I used to sing this song with Johnny. It would just mean so much to me. So I went over to his place. He's got a beautiful studio. And we had our arms around him. Go, go, Johnny, go. Johnny, be good. You know, it was just so much. It was just heartwarming, you know. And I just felt like, I said, this is my dream. This is what I wanted to have happen.
Mm.
And then when it came to a guitar player for the song, since he was going to do Stranger, and I wanted to let him do that, I was talking to Ross about this, and Ross Hogarth, like the two guys that you mentioned. when I was thanking Ross for turning me on to various people that I would not have thought of, and Doyle Bramhall Jr. being one, John McPhee to play Slide on Highway 61. I had forgotten about all that early Doobie Slide stuff. But he said, I know this guy, David Grissom. He's from Texas. He's from Texas.
I know. That helps.
He said, any song that we've discussed in relation to this album, David could just, like, do the exact authentic thing. He knows Johnny's style. And, you know, he's the guy. And he couldn't have been more right about that because I think maybe Joe's hesitancy because, you know, when you take, like, Chuck Berry, like, you know, it's such a classic thing, and you don't, well, like, am I just going to do that, or what can I do? Johnny had his take on that, and what David Grissom was able to do was he was familiar with both. And he incorporated both of those things, which I love, because it's got the Chuck Berry vibe, but it also has definite Johnny Winter vibe to it. So he put it right down the middle.
Good choice.
And he also played all the stuff on I'm Yours and I'm Hers.
Oh, like, that's a killer.
You know, and that's another great one that has
Billy Gibbons and Derek Trucks. I mean, for crying
out
loud.
And Derek Trucks.
Wow.
And, you know, when you're talking about Clyde, like Derek is just a great Clyde player.
Yep.
But he plays like he does a lot of things more like almost like a pedal steel player that, like, he'll do like, rather than, you know, like he does things that are more precision.
Yeah. Well, he grew up with the Allman Brothers, and his dad was a member of the band.
And Johnny loved, there are just various people that Johnny loved, but he really loved Derek and, what's the other, the guy that played on Memory Pain?
Warren Hayes. Yeah, Warren Hayes.
Warren and Derek both played with the Allman Brothers, and Johnny loved them both, and talk about them all the time. David Grissom played all of the, played throughout the, all the rhythms throughout that song. And that's great, like, Billy trading off with Derek.
Yeah.
It's a great
song. It's a killer song. There's so many great songs that you've collected, and it's not just because, that's not fair to say that, it's not just because it's your tribute to your brother, which is full of love. It's just great players playing great songs and doing things that this album is, you just want to have it, even without the history behind it. It's just great. It's great music. It's just, and that song you were talking about, I'm Yours, and I'm Hers, that's just a killer guitar song. And all these people are great. Kenny Wayne Shepherd, you know, he, with Still Alive and Well, he does a great job on that. And every one of these tunes is just, boy, can't get much better. Can't get much better.
Well, thank you. I certainly...
you did it.
You
did
know, when I started to make the record, the first question in my mind was, well, should just be a straight-ahead blues record just in tribute to the legacy that Johnny left behind, or should it be more of a personal tribute from me to my brother and include some of the songs that are not necessarily the best known, the more obscure Johnny songs that are my personal favorite. Yeah. Songs like Stranger and Self-Destructive Blues is always my favorite Johnny Shuffle. Drown in My Own Tears, which was not even a guitar song, but that Johnny did on the first CBS record. And I decided it should be
both
a balance of both.
Yeah, balance of both.
You know, what I tried to do. So it's definitely not the record Johnny would have made, but I think it is the record he would have wanted.
He would have loved. Loved it. He would love it.
Yeah. And, you know, Johnny always encouraged, he didn't try, he loved the fact that he wanted me to be myself. And, you know, he liked entrance and liked jazz and classical. He always encouraged me to follow my heart and do the stuff. Like, he never tried to get me to play like him, even though we did, in a lot of cases, do that, like on the Together record.
Yeah.
A lot of the songs that we played together as kids. But it just turned out, like, I thought, I knew it was going to be emotionally difficult.
Yeah.
And it was going to stir up a lot of childhood memories. But it turned out to be just a very uplifting, cleansing, healing experience, very cathartic. I remember when I finished the record, I had this immense feeling of relief and serenity.
Oh, that's
and
good.
Just like I felt like I actually knew Johnny better in an unexpected way that I never would have imagined. And I still talk to Johnny all the time. Like he may have departed this physical plane, but his presence and his music, his personality, they're going to live on in my heart forever.
They should.
And
everybody's.
Will live on through this record.
Yeah.
You know, that just like Bruce was saying, that people will go back and remember how great Johnny was in his prime, and that possibly a whole new generation of people that have never heard Johnny
I hope that they do. I'm talking to Edgar Winter, if you're just tuning in, on Real Bluegrass, and this great album, Brother Johnny. Every cut on it is just a wonderful monument and testament of love from Edgar and the musicians that joined on to it to make this great album, which just won the Grammy for Blues. I wanted to ask you this, too. Here, let me tell you this. And this is not my, it's not to talk about me, but I've always felt that Bob Dylan didn't know at the time, he wrote All Along the Watchtower for Jimi Hendrix. He just didn't realize that he did that until Jimi Hendrix recorded it. It's like, okay, that's his song forever and ever and ever. Other people do it, but it became Jimmy's. I also think that Bob Dylan wrote Highway 61 Revisited, didn't know at the time. He wrote it for Johnny because Johnny's version is just that much more real. I mean, when Johnny screams, I don't mean that he was screaming, but his comeback that God says, Abraham, when you see me coming, you better run. It's like, yeah, that's a little scary to think that, you know, it just had that little bit of edge to it. And I think Johnny's version of Highway 61 Revisited is just the absolute pinnacle of that song. Jumpin' Jack Flash, too. I think, okay, yeah, I grew up a Stones fan, but I still think that Johnny just took that song and made it his own. If you listen to the rock albums and the electric stuff, that's Johnny Winter. That's Johnny Winter music.
Those are the two songs that I picked. Like when I was thinking about the material, I thought, well, obviously, you got to do Still Alive and Well and Rock and Roll Hoochie Coo. And then there are Johnny's early songs that he wrote, like Mean Town and I'm Yours and I'm Hers.
Yeah.
And then there are those songs that became associated with Johnny, like Jumpin' Jack Flash that he played with Johnny Winter and, which I think was like a great rock band, you know.
Yeah.
Man for Man. Johnny and Rick and Randy Joe Hobbs on bass and Bobby Caldwell.
Yeah.
Powerhouse band.
Oh yeah.
And Jumpin' Jack Flash, Johnny loved the Stones. Like he, you know, just because of the blues influence. And he loved Dylan. He loved that whole mystique. And like, there were other songs like, Mr. Tambourine Man and like Rolling Stone. And Johnny did those songs. But the reason I picked Highway 61 was because of the slide play. And I said, well, of all the songs, Johnny loved Bob Dylan, but that was a great slide vehicle. And it was really interesting the way that song developed. It's more a straight ahead guitar song on Brother Johnny.
Mm-hmm.
And John McPhee plays great slide on it, but really Kenny Wayne is more his standard guitar playing that drives that song. And he ended up on there more or less accidentally when he came in to do his session. Phil X had already put the rhythm guitars on Still Alive and Well, and Kenny Wayne just played the fills and the solo, and it took him about like 30 minutes, and he said, is that it? And he said, well, is there something else? So we started playing some tracks, and we got to Highway 61. He said, oh, let me take a stab at that. And so I had just thought of it as a slide song, not a regular standard guitar. And, you know, when it came on, and he started doing that chunky rhythm thing, I said, man, this thing is rocking. And I almost wasn't going to put slide on it because it worked so well the way Kenny had approached it. But finally I said, well, it's got to have the slide.
Yeah.
You know, so. And then Ross suggested John McPhee once again, and you were talking about Phil X,
mm-hmm.
Who I didn't know anything about, who plays with Bon Jovi. He replaced Richie Sambora.
Oh, okay.
What a madman on guitar. I mean, talk about, like, playing with reckless abandon. Like, that's Phil. And I thought, like, I wanted on Jumpin' Jack Flash, I just want, fly out, crazy, over the top rock and roll.
Yep.
And Ross said, this guy that will do that for you is this guy, Phil X. He was right about that.
Yep. Hey, that's great. And John, when I hear the song in my head, Jumpin' Jack Flash, it's always Johnny's intro. It's always that guitar because it's like, it's not the Rolling Stones, and it shouldn't be. But on this version here with Phil X, it's a stronger, more muscular electric guitar sound. It's like you're going to hear Jumpin' Jack Flash, and it's going to drive you through the ceiling. And it's just I love. That's why I think he owns that. I think he owns that. I think Johnny owns that. And Highway 61 Revisited, and what was the other one? I was thinking, Johnny Be Good. Everybody does that one. But still, when I hear those, when I hear the kickoff in my head, the one that my mind selects is Johnny's. Always.
Yeah. Well, Johnny's with a high energy. Like, the Stones version is really laid back.
That's the difference, yeah.
And it's great. I mean, that is what the song is. But Johnny transformed that song into just a high energy rock song. And that, to me, that's that's where it likes to go, you know.
Because Johnny did it, that's where you think it should go, because Johnny took it there. You know, I didn't mean to cut you off, but that's the way I hear it. And it's always Johnny's intro, and it's always that starting. It's like, he's going to scream rock and roll or something. Doesn't have to, but boy, he owns that one. He owns that one. I love the selections you've done on this. So you've told me a little bit about Phil X. I don't want to leave anything out. Stormy Monday Blues is Robin Ford, who I think is one of the most ignored players who can do everything great. He plays jazz, he plays blues, he plays that. And selection of Robin Ford for Stormy Monday Blues, that was perfect. I'm so glad that he got the shine on that one.
Well, my thinking, and I did think of Robin specifically in relation to that song. Stormy Monday was one of those songs, like, you know, when Johnny and I would play in bands together, I wasn't interested in singing. I was really an instrumentalist and loving jazz and classical. I sort of thought of myself as a serious musician. Thankfully, I've gotten over that. But back then, you know, we'd play these four, like, we'd play clubs, you know, like 8 to 12 or 9 to 2, 4 or 5 hours. And, you know, and Johnny was singing that entire time. And once in a while, he'd say, "Hey, Edgar, sing a song." And the one I would always pick, I love the, you know, Stormy Monday is the T-Bone Walker song, but I love the Bobby Blue Band version.
Yeah. Cool.
And I also like the fact that it was fun to play around with, like in jazz, substitutions and changes. It had a little more of, progression, you know, jazzy progression than most of the blues songs did. And I always kind of gravitated toward that style. And when I started doing it, I just thought, if I can get Robin, you know, to hit me, this would suit his style just, you know, to perfection. And like you, like the thing that I most admire about Robin Ford is that I can't think of another player who can play both blues and jazz with the same artistry and the same intensity and actually play those styles, the authenticity. He can, you know, he can really play jazz. He played, you know, played with Miles, and for him to be able to just play blues with that, you know, I've heard him play it. You'd never know he was a jazz player or capable of doing that, because he just plays the blues.
Yeah,
that's hard to do.
It is.
You know,
it is.
It really is hard to do. You think, well, yeah, all you do, you just do that, but people don't. In most cases. And he just did the perfect blend on there, you know, just perfect. And I wasn't, you know, I had like a hard and fast rule that nobody on the record, I was going to be there for every note that was going to be played. And of course, we had no idea of the onset of COVID, which changed the entire.
Yeah, I was going to mention that. It kind of changed how you get it done, how you get it all produced.
Yeah. And there were a lot of, like, when it got toward the end of the album, the strings on End of the Line, which is another other song worth mentioning. When it got toward the end of the album, I realized, it's got all these great Johnny songs, but there's not a single Edgar song. There's not a song in my voice.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, you know, I should really write something. And so the title End of the Line flashed into my head, and I thought, it's kind of bluesy. Yeah, everybody knows what it's like to be at the end of the line. And I started to write it, and I said, I realized, I'm writing about the end of the winter line.
Oh.
You know, Johnny, neither Johnny or I have had children, and now Johnny's passed on. Mm. I am at the end of the line, and I started to, think of the song in a different way, and I thought, I almost did it in a blues style, but when I thought about Johnny, as I was saying before, Johnny always encouraged me to play my own style. The other thing that I thought about the whole album was, if I just did a Johnny copy record, I don't think Johnny would have, I think he would have said, "Hey man, you know what? All of a sudden you're just trying to play everything and sound like me, you know?" I think what he would have liked about this record is the fact, yes, I'm doing Johnny songs, but I'm doing them in a very personal way.
Yeah.
And all the people, that's what I encouraged everybody. I didn't try to get anybody to emulate Johnny's style or play like Johnny. I just wanted to get great songs, play Johnny's songs, and then have each of these people play it in their, to bring what they have, to that song. That's basically, and that's what I did with End of the Line, and I thought, well, I want to do it with strings. And, of course, with COVID, it was impossible when we did the horns on Drowning My Own Tears, we had to send that around to individual players. I called up Doc Kupka, the Tower Power, and he got some of the horn players. But we did actually do a string session, and Ross bravely volunteered to do that. I didn't get to be there for the string session.
So you're talking about the Dave Campbell strings on that End of the Line.
Yeah,
the last
Dave
cut.
Campbell.
By the way, that's
and Dave was a guy I knew from New York back in the 80s. A great guy and a great arranger. Rather than doing it myself, that I would like to get a real pro. And man, he did a great job. And I actually did it together. We had these endless phone conversations where we work on it, the transcription. But almost every one of my albums, there's one song that I feel like expresses how I felt at the time that album. I think of albums as sort of a snapshot of whatever it is that you happen to be going through in life at that time. And to me, that End of the Line, even though it's not a blues song, it's how I felt about making that record. And for that reason, I put it last.
Yeah, it's a great one to end with. Now that you've explained even more, I listen to it and I think I hear this vocal quality that you had in Living to Die or Dying to Live. I'm sorry. That's very
it
to
is,
me. That sounds similar.
Modern Dying to Live.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The last verse, songs may end or just fade away, but the music never dies.
Yeah.
Stars may burn, shine and burn in the night. Here on Earth, we hear their cry. But we all stand on the shoulders of those gone before. And as I was saying, Johnny wanted to be famous, and my dream was just to perpetuate music and to, the inspiration, the love and inspiration that I have felt through music, to be able to pass that on to future generations to come. And hopefully, when my time comes, my music will go on. And I hope that that this album will, that all the people who follow Johnny's and my career throughout all these years will come back and listen to it. And, that was one of the real reasons that I made the record. I really made it for purely love of music, my love for Johnny, and the blues, his style, for my mom and dad who passed on. They would love they would love the idea of my playing Johnny's music. And for all the Johnny's true and loyal fans, that, you know, I came to realize that it's more than just a tribute album. And, you know, I'm not really, I've never been a fan of tribute albums. To me, they're all too often more like copy albums or sound alike.
Cover, yeah. Yeah, well, like cover, yeah, I know.
I didn't want to make a record like that at all. And the other thing that I like, I thought maybe it's too much of a musician album. And I thought it stretches out, and there's a lot of self-indulgence and a lot of solo, you know, but that's what Johnny did.
Yeah.
I mean, it wouldn't be Johnny if it wasn't made that way. And the other thing is, I feel like we all want to, I think, feel like the time in which we came up was somehow special. But I really believe that the two golden eras in music were the 40s and 50s for big band jazz and swing, and the 60s and 70s. And I wanted to make this, like, even though a lot of the parts were done separately, it feels like a band album. And, you know, and it really is a band album, because it started out with my piano and then Greg Bissonette, a great drummer, just piano and drums.
Yeah, I read that.
And then there are only two bass players on the record, Bob Grob and Hurley, that played with John Mayer.
Yeah, I know who you're talking about. Yeah, he's in the notes.
Great bass player. But it has that, like, a lot of the music you hear today, it sounds like people just playing parts, you know, and there doesn't seem that sensibility of, like, all of these guest artists are band players. They know what it's like to play in a band, and it has that live feeling to me. So
it's great. It does have a live feeling to it. I've been talking to Edgar Winter, and I thank you so much, Edgar. I've been a fan of both you and your brother Johnny since way, way back. And the brother Johnny happens to be the name of this album. You've done a wonderful description. We've talked about the feel and everything, and the way you put it on End of the Line is the last song, and what that was really expressing. I want to tell you this. I saw both of you guys traveling live together, but it was several years ago, and I don't remember what year it was. And you came through my part of town. So I thought, man, I'm going to go see Edgar and Johnny. And
which is where, Steve?
Well, I live in northern Kentucky, which is south of Cincinnati. I'm a Kentuckian, but I live south of the Ohio River. I've always lived over here. So I think I went to see you and Johnny at a place in Kenton County that no longer exists. The venue is gone. I think it was called Coyote, I believe. But so I thought, man, what a great thing to get to see Edgar and Johnny together on stage. And Johnny did his thing. You played Frankenstein. You did your Edgar Winter group stuff. It was a great show. I was so pleased to be able to catch both of you together back. And that was, gosh, that might have, how long ago was it that you did your tour with Johnny back in those days? Was it 10? More than 10 years?
Yeah. You know, we would do, you know, to maybe two or three shows a year together.
Yeah, it wasn't a huge tour. I thought, man, you're right across the street from me, and I ran over and caught it. So, yeah, it wasn't that was a great show.
But I always welcomed every opportunity to play with Johnny, and we'd always, you know, do something together. There was a, you know, a thing called the Rock and Blues Fest that we did, that we were scheduled to do together, right? It was just 2 weeks after Johnny passed away.
Wow.
And I mentioned it in the liner notes, and I had thought, well, surely this is going to cancel.
Yeah.
Much to my surprise, they wanted me to go on as the headliner, sort of, and I thought, oh, this is, I don't know if I can do this. And at the end of my show, I normally end with Frankenstein, and I did, like, you know, Johnny Be Good, Bogemo Uchiku, two or three Johnny songs, you know, in honor of his passing.
Yeah,
and it kind of turned into a tradition, and everybody was so kind and supportive. Everybody would get up at the end of the show jammed together. And it really turned out to be a great source of strength and comfort playing that music. So, you know, shortly after Johnny passing, and that's what started me thinking about doing the album, you know. But I spent 3 or 4 years not doing it.
Well, yeah, but just like you said, you talked to your wife.
I couldn't have done it. I just was not emotionally.
Yeah, you had to be ready. You had to be ready.
Prepared to do it.
And it's so good, Edgar. It's such a great album. I listen and listen and listen. Every cut on here is worthy of singling out. We've talked about almost all of them, and we could go forever talking about all the people you pulled into play. They all played their hearts out and gave everything they had to every song. And it's a wonderful, wonderful album, Brother Johnny from Edgar Winter. Oh, you know, I looked at your website. It looks like you've got some touring dates starting in May, maybe on the West Coast, and you work your way a little east. So people can go to your website. It's easy. Look, type in Edgar Winter, and they can find out what you're doing. They can find this album. Also, I saw you.
Sir Ringo Starr, his all-star band, and Steve Lukather, of course, is part of that.
Yep.
And he played on Rock and Roll Ichiku and did this cool, twisted, demented kind of solo. I wanted to find somebody to play on that song that would not play anything like either Johnny or Rick would have played. And I kind of wanted to make it sort of maybe crazy, a little more Hendrix-y style. And, you know, that's just been great fun. And I love playing with Ringo. I mean, not only is the greatest drummer in the greatest band that's ever been, Johnny was a Stones guy.
You were a Beatles.
Love the Stones as well. But, you know, Ringo, the thing that I most respect about him is advocacy and outreach for peace and love, and being an old hippie myself.
Yep, me too.
You know, having played in the Woodstock era, and which is one thing. Woodstock is what changed my life, and I never thought about music the same after, because as I said, I was sort of a serious musician up to that point. But when I played Woodstock, the whole thing being set against the social backdrop of civil rights and the peace movement, I'll never forget being on stage and looking out over this endless sea of humanity and thinking, how did I get here? What is going on? It just made me realize that music was more than my own little personal private escape world, and that it was more than just entertainment or the artistic value of music, but that music actually had the power to reach out and bring people together in that unique way. And after Woodstock, that's when I started to think
really,
of what it would be like to be not just a musician, but an artist, you know, start writing songs and it really did change my life.
That's interesting.
And the thing I love, winning the Grammy is beautiful. I know Johnny, he's smiling down from blue heaven, but more than the award itself, it's the recognition, the acknowledgement, and the validation from the Academy, and, you know, the fact that I think as a result of that, more people will hear the album. It will reach more people.
That's my hope.
What's so gratifying about it to me is the fact that this is the music that we started out playing together as kids, the music we grew up on, and played in the style that we started out playing in bands together. And when we went to Woodstock, we were playing the blues. And then I diverged, and I did entrance with jazz and classical and all of that. And then White Trash, R&B band. And then
Winter
Group.
Yeah, was Save Our Planet the first song ever to talk about those bigger, Save Our Planet on White Trash.
Save
the Planet. Was that the first song that ever talked about saving the planet that we're still trying to do now?
No, I mean, we wanted to talk about it. We did.
Yeah.
You know, that's really what White Trash was about, is, you know, soul music and I think gospel is probably the most overlooked and misunderstood, or it's the flip side of the blues. And like, if you think rock and roll has intensity, if you ever been in one of those Pentecostal tent revivals,
well, that's where
it pales in comparison. And Save the Planet, we used to sneak into those as kids and Save the Planet. That's what that
becomes a church. It becomes a church song at the end. It's just this,
Oh, and God. Ray Charles was always like, if I had to name one person,
that's right,
probably my primary influence would be Ray.
Yeah.
I just feel like nobody could sing the blues like Ray Charles. Just like, I think, really changed everything. Just the intensity sincerity of the way he sang. Even people that subliminally, they might not be trying to sound like Ray Charles, but everybody wanted to have that.
Yeah, why not?
That could be able to touch people the way he did.
Yeah.
You know, with his vocals.
Golly, this is, this has been so nice of you to talk to me about this music and your music and everything, and Brother Johnny, I appreciate it so much.
It's been a pleasure, Steve.
Thank you, and I'm going to leave you with the audience. I'll say goodbye to you. I'll play for them Johnny Be Good off of the Brother Johnny album. You've described it. We could go on forever just talking about all the additional people. Hey, let me ask you this before I say goodbye. The note, the book, the 20-something page written, is that in the LP also? Is there a version of that in the LP album, do you know?
Yeah.
Okay.
Have you not seen the vinyl?
I have, and I love that picture that focuses back and forth. And I think what I'm going to do now is go find that, because can describe it.
Yeah. There's a nice, big, beautiful. It's of course not as many pages because it's bigger, but yes, it is. It is included in the album, of course.
And then the photograph on the front is the same, except that it transfers back and forth between your image and Johnny's.
Yeah, yeah. It is what they call a lenticular. It's like a 3D image that shifts back and forth.
Yeah, yeah.
You hold it at one angle, and you see my face, and then you tilt it slightly, and you see Johnny's. So that family resemblance. That was my idea from the very beginning. I said, when we got a little way into the album, I said, wow, we're making a really special album here, and it's going to need some kind of a unique cover. And that was what I remember, like when I was a kid, seeing these little buttons, and it would say something like, I can make you a picture of Eisenhower, and then you'd tilt it, and it would say, I like Coke, and there'd be a frosty glass of Coca-Cola. And I used to think those things were magical. And I thought, how cool would it be if you had this thing and it would shift back and forth like that?
So, I'm going to get it. I'm going to get it. I got the CD and I travel around with it, but I'm going to get the LP for that. And then I may hang it on the wall. But, man, Edgar Winter, thanks so much, man. I love everything that you've done through your career. I love Johnny's music. This Brother Johnny is such a great, it's just an act of love. And everybody on it just loved it and loved the music. And we're going to let you go back to whatever you may want to do the rest of your evening. Appreciate your time. We'll leave.
You're very welcome. And I just want to close by thanking all our fans throughout all of these years. You know, we couldn't have done anything we did without you. And, you know, we love you all. And it's meant the world to us to be able to do what we most love and see you all out there rocking and having a great time. So I hope to see you out this summer.
Oh, yeah.
Ringo and on that long and grinding road, and until then, all I can say is Johnny and I have always said, don't forget to keep on rocking.
Thanks, Edgar.